Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solaria Report. Tonight is our quarterly discussion with the Saker, the emerging multipolar world. Tonight we're going to be talking about, will there be war in Iran? As you all know, the Saker has extraordinary and very deep experience and background as a military analyst. There's nobody better to discuss this with. Before we start, I just want to say a few words about his website, the Vineyard of the Saker. I touch base there at least once a week to kind of see what's going on. I'm just preparing for this interview. I've been back and rereading a lot of the materials I read weekly. And I can't recommend it to you enough. In particular, for those who like to read, the Saker has two books, The Essential Saker number one, The Essential Saker number two. And if you dive in and try and understand the emerging multipolar world, what you discover, it's a big planet. There are many different cultures. It's rich, complex. And his books give, I think, one of the best and certainly the most fascinating description of that world. And he takes and dives in lots of different places. As you all know, on the first one, I couldn't stop laughing when I was reading his book. I was very depressed when it was over because, you know, what was going to get me laughing during mealtimes, because I was reading it during lunch and dinner. Anyway, so check out The Vineyard of the Saker, and if you love to read, these books will give you remarkable insight into what's going on in our world at a much richer, deeper level than we're used to seeing. So with that, Saker, welcome to the Solaria Report.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your very kind introduction.
Well, you know, one of the great things about your website is not just the people you publish in the commentary, but the comments. I mean, the comments, you're getting rich insight and comments from all over the world. So your website has the best comment discussions. And of course, you have some pretty serious moderators too.
Well, I think it's entirely their credit because, yes, it is heavily moderated. I often get criticized for that. I actually think it's the correct policy. Because if you look, if there is no moderation or weak moderation, it's instantly hijacked by all sorts of characters, ranging from paid trolls to nutcases to whatever you want. So it really is right. The credit of the moderators doing a superb job.
Right. And so you get the very, very rich discussion. Okay, well, I said to you earlier before, we're here to talk about will there be war in Iran, and if so, what does that mean? But before I dive in and go direct to that, I want to provide a lot of background. And I want to start with something called FASB 56, which we talked about last time. I'll be sending it to you shortly. I just published The Real Game of Missing Money. It's a definitive collection of all the information on the missing money. But of course, the last big action was October, while everybody was paying attention to Kavanaugh's teenage sex life. FASB 56 was promulgated, and my description of it is, oh, an infinite amount of secret money for secret armies. And my big concern is that it gives the administration the ability, essentially, as long as we're the reserve currency, to funnel as much money as they need to people like the Israelis and the mercenaries. But right after it happened, we see Mattis and Kelly use their incredible gravitas to persuade Congress to give us, and sort of the political system, to give us unprecedented increases in defense appropriations. But as soon as FASB 56 is passed, Mattis is out, Kelly is out, and Kelly's replaced by the guy who engineered FASB 56, who I would describe as a Bush guy. And we see the Bush guys, you know, basically Trump make a deal with the Bush and Barr go into DOJ, and the Iran-Contra team is back. So to me, this change in the freedom of the funding mechanism means the neocons in the White House now have incredible secret resources at their command.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. But the thing is that having a lot of money does not now translate with having a more effective foreign policy, be it on a military or diplomatic level or economic level. I mean, I agree with you that the neocons are doing what they're doing, what they're good at, which is corruption and big money and, blind support for Israel and stuff like that. But I think the most striking, or at least to me, the most striking development really is to what degree this does not correlate with a you know, an effective toolkit for foreign policy issues. Right. I mean, it's absolutely amazing for me to see how weak the empire is. It's weaker than I thought, and I thought it was pretty weak.
Right. So I would say this gives them the ability to make much more spectacular messes.
Yes, it's exactly it. That is all it's going to achieve.
So one of the things we see Kelly say, he just did an interview, his first big interview since he left the administration, is he says Ivanka needs to go home. I don't know if you saw that. Ivanka, everyone, is the nickname for Jared Kushner and his wife Ivanka Trump. I don't know if you saw the Trump signing the deal that basically allowed Netanyahu to move in on the territories freely, but Trump looked furious and very angry and tense. And Jared Kushner and Netanyahu were like dancing. And you wanted to say to Netanyahu and Kushner, look, don't dance. It's really bad politics to make this look like what it is. You know, you're behaving like psychopaths who don't appreciate that the audience is watching.
Yeah, but I think they're right, because the audience is watching, but the audience doesn't do anything about it. So essentially, they don't give a damn about the audience anymore. I mean, that's one of the things that's so impressive to me. If we compare the Obama years to the Trump years, Obama was just as bad as Trump, if not worse. But it all was, you know, what I call democracy with a human face.
Right.
The guy was nice. He had the charm of a car salesman, which is very effective in its own way. The current administration, and I think it works exactly the same thing is true for Netanyahu and the Israelis, they don't give a damn about the public opinion anymore. They know they're hated, they know they're despised, and they don't care because they're so superior and they can corrupt anybody. So they think they can get away with that. And I think they're mistaken.
Right.
But for the short term, yeah, they are actually doing the right thing. They're ignoring us.
Okay, so among other things, we have Jeff Gundlach, who I would consider the top bond manager in the United States, out and about constantly pointing out the fact that we're in a debt spiral up and the federal finances are starting to hit the wall that we've all known. I'm assuming that's part of why Trump is doing what he's doing on the trade war. But what that means is it's very clear foreigners are not financing our game anymore, and that puts America, you know, in a real squeeze. Now, Pompeo, because one of the questions I have is why in the world is Mike Pompeo behaving the way he's behaving? First and foremost, he gave a speech to the oil guys, which was made public. You had it on your website. You wrote published a great article about the speech. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it.
No, I don't. Which article are we calling here? I'm not sure what you mean.
I'm pretty sure it was on your site or then I found it through your site. He gave a speech to the oil guys and he talked about how they were going to shut down sales by Syria, Iran, and Venezuela and drive the price up.
Do they really want to do that when the beneficiaries of that price increase would be Russia?
Well,
first and foremost.
I would say in certain cases, yes, because if you look at the debt markets and the derivative markets, how dependent they are on the oil companies and fracking, and mm-hmm. how important the export of oil is to the United States. I think, yeah, I think they'll let Russia make a little bit of money if they can get that oil price up. So I agree with you. That's, you know, that's one of the reasons in the 80s they drove the price down. But right now, I think I would argue they need the price up.
I know that they're importing Russian oil in the U.S. right now. It's on the increase.
Really?
To substitute for the Venezuelan one.
Wow.
Yep.
Well,
so there's all sorts of weird things happening that you know, it doesn't seem to make sense. I think, frankly, I am not convinced that there is a foreign policy that's, you know, centralized by either an individual or a group of people. It's sort of, and this already began with Obama. You had basically individual actors or agencies having their own foreign policy.
Right.
And they're all pursuing whatever it is that they're interested in. And what we see is what I call a resulting vector, which appears to be schizophrenic. Well, because it is.
Right. Right. Because different factions are lobbying for their piece of the pie. So then we have Pompeo give a speech where he openly admits that he's been trained to lie.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, we can post that.
And you cannot fathom, you know, you cannot fathom a Jim Baker doing that. In other words,
of course not.
Right. It's kind of like, why would you do that? Now, I'm going to say something a little bit off color, you know, but when you were in the Bush, and when I was in the Bush administration, you'd see a politician for the first time in his life get his own plane, you know, because his status was something like Secretary of the State, and he'd get sex slave privileges. And the next thing you know, he was acting like he lost his mind. It was like a power drunk. And I watch Pompeo, and his behavior reminds me of that. I'm not saying that's what it is, but his behavior doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. We know he's a smart guy. I mean, he graduated first in his class, I think, at West Point. This is not a stupid man. Why is he behaving like this?
Does he have any other option? I mean, can that system produce a different kind of Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense or National Security Advisor? I mean, it seems to me that the problem is we're beyond individuals now. It's really systemic, and it produces a specific kind of individual. And by the way, the very same Pompeo, who used to make lots of roaring statements, once he got to Russia, he was actually on his best behavior.
Right.
Which tells you again that it's all situational, you know, morality or ethics. It depends on what he's doing and who he's speaking to. And of course, nobody can. The funny thing is that the Trump administration actually thinks that somebody would want to negotiate with them when they've proven beyond any reasonable doubt that they cannot negotiate. And if they do, they will break the terms of the deal.
Right.
Basically, I mean, it invalidates. If you take away negotiations, if you take away diplomacy, what's left in your foreign policy? Just threats.
War. Right.
War. Yeah, but that shouldn't be a foreign policy. That should be at the last resort.
Well, but
in the war part, what's interesting is I really contend that the U.S. military as an instrument of foreign policy is useless.
Right.
It can destroy many things. It can. It's not that it can't do anything. It can't do anything useful to the foreign policy. That's what's so important to understand. War is a continuation of politics by other means. And if your instrument of war is unable to deliver anything, it basically turns into a gigantically expensive, obscenely expensive, but useless item.
Okay, so that let's turn to Venezuela. Because one of the things we saw in Venezuela is for the third time a CIA engineered coup fail, which means, you know, people once upon a time were afraid of the neocons because their coups would succeed. Now we're talking about, you know, three strikes and you're out. So Venezuela is a spectacular example of the strategy not working. Tell us what happened in Venezuela.
Well, in Venezuela, frankly, I mean, it just blew my mind. I never thought it would get so ridiculous. I thought, because Venezuela really, if we take the countries that basically openly resist the empire, so it would be, you know, Russia, China, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, I mean, these would be the list. Venezuela is really the weakest link in that chain. Venezuela is in a terrible situation internally, terrible situation geographically. It's surrounded by more or less different degrees of hostility, and it's right in the U.S. backyard. You would think it would be a no-brainer. Well, they completely failed. And first of all, a dismal failure in analysis. I mean, how could they believe that Guaido? They seem to have believed what exiles told them. I mean, I can't imagine any other explanation for that. And they completely failed. It embarrassed themselves. And you're right, it's the third time in a row. It basically means that now anybody can laugh at Uncle Sam. Because if the Venezuelans get to, I mean, who doesn't? I mean, maybe they can reinvade Grenada. And the first time around, I remind you, they had a very, very hard time invading Grenada, actually, which is usually hidden from public knowledge. But
right.
Grenada was a disaster, militarily speaking. They didn't lose because they couldn't lose, but they came as close as possible. You know, that just proves again that the U.S. is punching, I think the American expression is, way above its weight.
So also I want to turn to Cuba, because Cuba, I just had a friend come back from Cuba and saying, literally, she was working with the doctors there. You know, the doctors are trying to operate on a diet well below what they need, basically, to maintain health.
Mm-hmm.
So Cuba is also really struggling with the sanctions from the U.S. and the U.S. breaking its steel there.
Yeah, but Cuba is well known to have an established and effective military intelligence community. I mean, that's a tough one. The U.S.
Right.
has tried to defeat Cuba for decades and never came close. So I would think that, you know, if you start by the easy one, first you go for Venezuela, then eventually ask, I think Pompeo said, right? Nicaragua and Cuba would be next. Well, well how CIA, can you make such threats if you can't even deal with Venezuela?
Well, but the theory always has been that if we have the reserve currency, then you just erode the other guy. You know, we can outlast. It's an endurance game. So we can throw a lot of money. We can make a big mess. And ultimately, we can just drive everybody into the ground, whether it's Russia, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Cuba, whether it's Iran. That's the whole idea of the financial sanctions. But I would say it's not working as planned.
Well, I think there's one thing that's absolutely crucial. There are really two worlds out there, two realities. I mean, there is the reality that you can see in the U.S. media. And in that reality, the U.S. is a superpower. As they like to say, they have the best military in history. You get all this nonsense about we'll come and we'll bomb you, you know, into submission. I mean, all this huffing and puffing looks tremendously credible, and everybody's shaking in their boots of abject terror. And then there's the real world out there, where people are scoffing, laughing, dismissing, openly, you know, daring to defy the U.S. And that other reality is just never openly discussed because it is based on a number of assumptions, which I think are still crucially accepted by most people in this country. For instance, that the military is such an effective and formidable military. You can even see that in people who oppose wars. They still have that, you know, that ready sentence, the strongest military in history. It's nonsense. It's absolutely false. It's counterfactual, but it doesn't matter.
Right. No matter how many wars we lose, we keep...
Exactly.
So I go back to the statement attributed to Karl Rove that was in Paul O'Neill's book, where he said, you know, we're an empire now, we make our own reality. You fellows are in the objective reality-based world, and we don't have to obey that world anymore. Now, if you go out on the Silk Road, I just got back from Thailand, if you go out on the Silk Road, the majority of the world and the majority of the world's economy is in the objective-based reality. It has to, because if you're not in objective-based reality, the planes fall out of the sky and the bridges fall down. So everybody else is trying to make money and pay their rent in the objective-based reality. And it's interesting, wherever you go in the old Bretton Woods system, so in the last 2 years I've been in Thailand, I've been in Australia, I've been in Hong Kong, I've been in New Zealand – all of them don't want the U.S. to fail. They're under that national security umbrella, and they are rightly very afraid of China. But what's interesting is they are all, this year, they're all saying, well, we don't have that choice. America is failing. They talk about the failure as if it's a fait accompli, and they're now making other plans.
Well, they have no other option. I think we've seen that brilliantly illustrated by the South Koreans, who used to be, you know, very much an occupied country, a comprador regime, the U.S. was in control. Well, look what they did when Trump threatened the formidable armadas. They suddenly opened bilateral negotiations on their own with the North and actually got a number of agreements, including over the Olympics, et cetera. And I think a similar thing is happening in Europe right now, where even people who would not necessarily share our political beliefs about war or peace or empire are basically saying the U.S. just can't deliver anymore. We need to function.
Right. Right. They have to function in the objective-based reality.
Yeah, they totally do.
Right. They have to do whatever they have to do. Now, one of the things that's interesting when you go out on the Silk Road, guess who's the Israelis are there trying to do IT cybersecurity deals and get into everybody's systems everywhere. And so... It's kind of interesting because they figured out a way to come out on top whether the U.S. fails or not.
Yeah, but they're pursuing completely different goals.
Right.
And the Israeli goals are understandable. I mean, they want, the IT slice of the bigger pie.
Right.
Whereas the U.S. is, first of all, I don't think, again, there's a clear strategy of what they want to do with that Silk Road. But I think it's pretty clear they want to either be part of it or sabotage it. But again, their interest—the interest of the entire Eurasian landmass is exactly the opposite. There's no way they're going to prevail. The same way, I don't understand how a country with 300 million people can actually enter a trade war with a country whose internal market is, 1.3 billion people.
Well, we have to rebalance our trade with China. We knew that, and I think at the heart of this trade war is the fear that, I mean, if you look at our global control, much of it is dependent on the IT systems. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you've seen the documentary on called Zero Days about the Stuxnet virus. It's a great description of that dynamic. And mm-hmm. this fight over 5G, at the heart of the fight is, you know, whose platform is it going to be? Is it going to be the Chinese platform, or is it going to be the Anglo-Zionist platform? That's part of what that's about. And that's a zero or one issue.
Yeah, but see, the thing is that they have no chance of winning. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Not when there's such huge financial interest. I mean, just the market that China, first of all, the U.S. is a small share of the Chinese international trade. And there's the entire region that they won't prevent China from participating. Huawei will be the number one company. The entire Eurasian landmass, the U.S. just cut itself off it.
Right.
And another thing, which is also a very serious sign of decline in any empire, is when you contradict your own ideology. And when you say, you know, we're for free trade, and then you actually hide tariffs, you know, you call them sanctions, but essentially they achieve the same result. You're going into protectionism. I mean, whatever you think of, whatever your ideas of economics are, protectionism is not what this country is supposed to stand for. Yet it clearly does. And it's the only way it can still hope to compete, which is pathetic.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's why I was out in 1998. But America and China are both betting on technocracy, not on markets. And I think they're both wrong. And my fear is you split the world into two sort of technocratic systems, both of which are deeply unattractive. It's what it looks like to me. So let me turn, you just published a new great article, and then you published an interview with Dmitry Orlov that I want to bring up before we dive into Will There Be War? In your article, I thought you made one of the great powers of your book is you always come back to the understanding that geopolitics plays on a platform of our culture and history. And you always go deep on those things. And one of the things you talk about in your most recent article is the extraordinary debasement of the culture in the United States. Not something I'm happy about, but something which I think is unbelievably powerful and important. And, you know, I don't know if you saw this. Somebody published an article the other day when one of the pharmacies that delivers to Congress noted how many Alzheimer's drugs they were shipping over to Congress.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
Right. So one of the things I talk a lot about on the Solari Report is on the entrainment technology which is being used. And I literally, you know, I literally think that all the lying, all the secrecy, all the push to convert news to entertainment, all these different things are literally destroying America's mind. I mean, when you're out in Thailand and you look back and you listen, it's as though the place has gone mad. It's like watching a nut house.
Yep. And if you compare the kind of exams U.S. Americans were taking in the beginning of the 20th century in schools and what they're taught today, it's just night and day completely.
Right.
There's definitely a de-evolution happening on many, many levels in the U.S., unfortunately, right now. I think, and most people who are, you know, in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, remember that the country changed dramatically over the past decades, and not for the better.
Well, one of the things you point out, and I've written and talked a lot about this, is that you had a survey where 98% of American males had used pornography in the last 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I bring that up because pornography, to me, has been one of the most economic ways to get control files on people.
Yeah.
You know, it's relatively easy to entrap somebody from pornography into some kind of pornography that has an underage person, and then you've got them.
Yep, absolutely.
Yep.
The same thing for homosexuality, by the way, which in the past used to be considered a security risk. You wouldn't get a security clearance because you can be the object of blackmail.
Right. Right. So, well, I happen to think that, you know, the strategy to basically get control files on people through the systems has been a very well thought out and very intentional policy. So you look at this, and I've seen other things happen and other signals that indicates that the CIA would love to do the rape of Russia here. And one of my greatest concerns about war in Iran is the goal to, you know, to control Iran, or is the goal to, you know, basically destroy the U.S. and do the rape of Russia here?
Well, I think the situation with Iran and Russia are really completely different. Because in Russia, Russia benefits from having that ultimate last argument that, you know, if things go completely out of control, Russia can destroy the entire United States within about 2 hours.
Right.
Which Iran can't do. So this, to me, translates into the neocons, you know, however crazy they are and out of touch with reality, they probably are more inclined to fear Russia than they would be fearing Iran.
Right.
And there would be a very good reason to fear Iran, but I don't think they're sophisticated enough to understand what that reason is. Whereas with Russia, it's simple. You know, under 20 minutes and the U.S. does not exist anymore. That's clear. With Iran, it's much more complex, and it depends on many assumptions that you make. You know, when you look at a war, like a potential war between the empire and Iran, it crucially depends on so many assumptions that the outcome is very hard to predict. All you would say is that it's extremely dangerous situation, and I think any responsible military analyst would say, don't do it.
So one of the questions is Netanyahu. Netanyahu just won his election, and, you know, it certainly looks like if there's anybody driving the train towards war, it's Netanyahu and his backers trying to get Trump to go to war. Now, Trump's initial policy statements was quite the opposite.
Yes.
But you watch what's happening and you say, you know, are they blackmailing Trump? Do they control the reserve currency so he has to do what they say? It almost looks like the Clinton, you know, the Clinton post, the Monica Lewinsky effort at impeachment. So are they depending on Israel for all their covert operations in numerous places around the world? How is it that Netanyahu's got Trump over a barrel?
Well, because Trump is surrounded by neocons, and Trump betrayed all the people who were his closest and most influential friends and supporters who could have resisted them. I mean, it was clear to me as soon as he fired Flynn, we would end up in that situation. Right. Flynn was, you know, one can have reservations about some of the things Flynn said and did. I'm not saying he is my hero, but I'm saying objectively, Flynn was, I would say, the embodiment of Trump's campaign promises in terms of international security.
Right.
He had certain very clear ideas. I mean, Flynn had all sorts of goofy ideas about Iran and China. But for instance, he clearly said, we need to work with the Russians to pursue our common interests. That's the first person that the neocons tossed out of there. And I really don't like Brennan, but he's another one. And they also tossed him out. So it's not surprising that Trump right now is completely alone. I mean, we discussed it in last time. It is possible that Mad Dog Mattis, was the sanest person in the White House
right. When
he was still there. That's scary. That's not good news. When you end up hoping that Mattis will prevail, it tells you how desperate the situation is. So by now, right. I think Netanyahu has total control. I mean, the U.S. is essentially an occupied country and has been for a while now. But also keep in mind this, Netanyahu wants the U.S. to fight on the behalf of Israel.
Right.
Well, he's not exposing his own people, at least. I mean, not directly.
Well, I would say he wants...
If Trump gives the order to attack, it's all of CENTCOM that's going to be exposed.
Right. So I would say it's not just Netanyahu, because Israel's a country of 4 million people. If you look at who Netanyahu's backers are in the city and in Beverly Hills and in New York, you know, we're talking about a network. But there's
yes,
no doubt
absolutely.
You go to war in Iran, you know, it's kids from the 7 southern states of the United States who will die. And then it's a relatively small network of people who will win.
Benefit, yes.
Right.
And not only that, I really think that there's many ways that I can credibly describe how you would start a war with Iran. I have no idea how you would stop it. Because wars typically, you know, if there is a zero sum and there's a complete incompatibility, which would happen if the war became overt. It's been a covert war going on for decades now. But I mean, let's say that it really happens. At that point, the Iranians, they have no reason to negotiate with Americans whatsoever. And they have such a wide spectrum of possible responses, none of which is clear. How do we? What's the step after that? I really think it would make Iraq look like a cakewalk. Iraq is just an easy,
well, that's what Tulsi Gabbard
said. To do.
She said
she's
cakewalk.
Right. She's absolutely right.
Yeah, she's absolutely right.
And on her video, she first put it quotes by Trump. you know, that said we can't fight regimes we barely understand. We destabilize entire regions. Trump, during his campaign, said all the right things. He really did.
So here's the question. Let's say that the United States declared war on Iran. I would say that war is impossible to win.
Oh, I completely agree with you. The very, very, very first article I ever wrote for my blog was about the prospects of the empire attacking Iran.
I remember. I read it.
Right. And I think it's the fundamental logic is still true. If anything, it got worse for the empire. And I agree, this war is completely unwinnable because what kind of – if the idea is just – Well, if you want, do you want to go through possible scenarios?
Yeah. Let's go. Let's say you are the head of you're the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You've been ordered to go to war. What do you do?
I say over my dead body, Mr. President, and I will not execute your order. That's what I would do. What right, I think so, Fallon told when he was chief of CENTCOM, he said, you know, not on my watch. That would be my response.
Right.
Because here's the deal. Let's take three basic scenarios. The first one, kind of a pinprick, symbolic strike, you know, just to feel good, the kind of stuff the Israelis have been doing in Syria. And say you hit a number of high visibility targets, you know, Bushehr, you hit, you know, some so-called research centers, etc. All it will do is solidify Iran's resolve. That's all you achieve. There's no way Iran is going to go, oh my God, they mean serious business, let's surrender and roll over. It's just not going to happen. So that's a ridiculous scenario. Let's try something more serious. Eric Margolis wrote an article recently about that, where I think, if I remember correctly, he said that the first day of airstrikes, missile and bomb strikes, would take 2,100.
It was 2,300
strikes on the first day. Right. That basically tells the Iranians, this is a total war. And we need to prevail, at which point the entire Middle East blows up. Because the Iranians are not only very sophisticated, they are deployed all over the region, they have long-range weapons, they have extremely competent special forces, they have a fantastic intelligence community. They will hurt the U.S. really badly. At which point, what can the U.S. do? More of the same? Another 2,300 strikes? And for how many days? Okay, I will agree, for instance, that the carriers are probably safe from the Iranians because they will be out of the Persian Gulf if real shooting starts. And I do agree that the U.S. can destroy the Iranian air defenses, Navy, and Air Force. But then what? Then you're essentially looking at a scenario. The one I always mention is 2006, the Israeli attack on Lebanon and Hezbollah specifically. The Israelis had complete naval supremacy, complete aerial supremacy. They had vastly superior artillery. They sent their best forces into southern Lebanon, and they entered. They could enter. The Hezbollah could not stop them from entering. But the point is, they couldn't even control a village that's, you know, 2 miles off the Israeli border. Throughout the 33-day war, the Hezbollah had people there that were resisting. Iran makes that look like a cakewalk. So that would be a nightmare.
You have 80 million people who don't want to be occupied.
And with lots of allies all over. I mean, Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq, Hezbollah in Lebanon, these are serious fighting forces. And the key thing is they want the fight. They're not afraid whatsoever.
So, so let's say the U.S. tries to engage in an air war. Does Iran shut down the straits?
Yes. If they believe it's for real, they might not if it's a pinprick. They might threaten. But if it's for real, I mean, if it's we're talking 2,300 sorties per day, absolutely. Now, the U.S. could. I think I disagree with those who say there's no way the U.S. cannot, you know, try to keep the Strait of Hormuz open. They can. First of all, they can turn the northern, the northern rim of the Persian Gulf, which has a lot of artillery misses, etc. First of all, you turn that into a free fire zone. You really hit it extremely hard. And then the number mentioned by Bolton, the 120,000 troops sent there, that is what you would need to try to basically not invade Iran, but at least push them away from the Strait of Hormuz as far as much as can be. And then basically resist and protect throughout the Middle East CENTCOM's units and forces. And thank God it doesn't seem that it's going to happen.
Where are you going to get 120,000 troops?
Oh, and the only place you can really put them in is it would be Saudi Arabia. And then you can sort of try to, but the problem is all the countries around Iran don't want that war. So it's going to be another big headache. They don't, they're not going to help. The Iraqis already said that. I think the Turks said that too. There is zero support. So it's going to be a very, very dangerous attempt. If the U.S. tries to fight Iran to keep open the Strait of Hormuz, it probably can do it, but the cost would be horrendous. And that means Trump can kiss his re-election goodbye. That's probably what keeps him right now. Probably somebody right. tells him that we're going to have such a problem that's not going to be solved by the time you run again.
No, if he tries to do a land war in Iran, he loses the election.
Well, a purely air war is dangerous because Iran is not going to respond in the air.
Right.
It's going to respond on land.
Well, then if he tries to do an air war against Iran, then he loses the election.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that might be the final collapse of the U.S. empire, because I think the U.S. is going to tank the entire world economy. The political tensions are going to go through the roof. And frankly, I should tell you one more thing, which is very pessimistic, but I think they're crazy enough to consider using nuclear weapons on Iran. They haven't done it so far. I totally disagree with those who say that there was nuclear devices set up in Yemen and Lebanon. I mean, I know some people say that. I think it's nonsense. But it is true that during Desert Shield, when the 82nd was sent to Saudi Arabia, I think it was Cheney who was asked, well, what happens if the Iraqi armored corps crossed the border and attack? I mean, that's still a very weak force compared. It's infantry, essentially. And he said, well, the first line of defense would be obviously the carriers and the tactical aviation on carriers. But secondly, he said, you know, and we looked, the option was to use nukes. I think they considered that. We know that U.S. considered that in the past, also during the Korean
right.
War.
Right.
I think that if they really get hurt, they actually might start using tactical nukes. I wouldn't put it past them. They're crazy enough for that.
But if you're Russia and you see them use tactical nukes, what's your response?
You do whatever. Your response has to be, first of all, political, as strong as you can, because there is a huge political price that you can extract from the empire for doing so. I mean, the world opinion is going to just explode in outrage.
Right.
But secondly, militarily, you try to stay out of it. You do not want to be involved with a nuclear power that's gone crazy.
Right.
So I think all Russia can do is, of course, I mean, anything that looks like a real war in the Middle East would happen the same thing that happened the first time around, which is the Russian military would go on full alert, would be ready for any contingency. But I don't think they're going to enter a direct shooting war with the U.S. because that would expose Russia to a crazy nuclear power. That's not what Putin has been elected to do.
So in 2014, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations described the neocons and what they're up to is the unraveling. In other words, their cowboy behavior was unraveling the world order. And every time I thought the empire was going to come to the end, I saw two things happen. One was, I would describe it as secret weapons, I'm guessing. You know, I can't prove that. And covert operations. So you would see covert warfare, both through the information systems using to blackmail and bribe people, like getting Japan to go along, or, you know, things like tsunamis that were mysteriously timed. And then suddenly America would be back in the game. So what that said to me is we've got invisible weaponry, whether through the systems, i.e. things like the Stuxnet virus, or ways of blackmailing people behind the scenes, or ways of delivering, you know, fire from the sky. And those things continue to extend the life of the empire. And so, because I don't understand really what's behind those and what their tactical options are, my question is that toolkit available to keep this thing going longer than you and I would think it should?
I think depends which parts. You mentioned several things. First of all, covert operations, yes, very much so, particularly corruption. The empire has really a distinguished and long experience in corrupting people. And that weapon still functions very well. But when you're dealing with people who are harder, not impossible to corrupt, but very substantially harder, that weapon is not very effective. The example that comes to mind to me immediately is Hezbollah again, which the very first time I got interested by this movement, I spoke to somebody who just come back from Lebanon and said, you know, corruption is endemic there. The only people who don't take money are the people from Hezbollah. And I started researching them because I thought, that's interesting. Who are these people? And indeed, I think they're actually, I really believe that the leadership of that organization and most members are profoundly idealistic and incorruptible.
Right.
I think a lot of the U.S. had a successful attempt at an attempt was successful. It wasn't successful at the end, but the attempt was strong during the what I call the Gucci Revolution in Iran when they tried to overthrow the Islamic Republic and put Rafsanjani in power. That's the kind of stuff that are possible. Obviously, there's corruption in Russia, and the U.S. can use that. So that is an effective weapon. The secret weapons, I personally don't believe they exist. And the reason why is that a weapon has to be not only tested, it has to be practiced with. If it is any kind of new technology, you don't know how it will actually perform in a battlefield. So it's one thing to write a virus, which is sort of contained. Your environment is the computer. The real warfare is much more fluid, much more complex. And I don't believe you can I don't think a weapon is effective unless it has been extensively tested and tested in combat. And units need to practice with. And I don't see that the U.S. Tactics have changed in any significant way to indicate, for instance, the availability of some kind of secret weapon. So I don't think they exist. I might be mistaken, but that's my best guesstimate.
Yeah, I disagree with that, but I think there's only so much you can do with them if they do. The one thing I would point out is the stock market, if you just look at the money, the stock market needs the threat of war, but they decidedly do not need war. In other words, they don't want war. They just want the constant threat of war. That's how they make money. And the only thing that would trump that financially is if the reserve currency was basically, you know, about to collapse. And this was, you know, would you drop a nuclear bomb to keep the reserve currency going? I wouldn't, but there are those who will.
Yeah. I'm sure there are those who will. Absolutely, yes. And that's what has been my biggest concern for all these years, is that I'm truly, truly afraid that the weakening of the empire makes the empire far more dangerous, because if you look at the U.S. armed forces, I think the nuclear triad is the part that works best. That's the one that's effective. That's the one that can actually deliver on its design specs. The issue is, how much good would it do to actually be used? I think it would be a disaster, but it's one that can look tempting to somebody who's losing.
Well, it would be a disaster to the U.S. Would it be a disaster to Israel?
I think yes, actually, because I don't believe that the fundamental notion of Israeli, let's say, presence in the Middle East is that we're superior to everybody, Arabs only understand violence, and will terrify everybody into submission. I don't think that can work. And Israel is going to be a target for sure. If there is neither the Iranians and the Lebanese understand perfectly who is, you know, holding the real power, the key to the attack. And the Israelis know they're going to get hit. And the Israelis is a typical example. It's a very small country with no strategic depth, and their nuclear weapons are not very useful to them, actually. Because if they use the nuclear weapons, say against Iran or say against Hezbollah, etc., they would not militarily degrade them. It would not change the fundamental conventional balance. It would just make things worse. Because at that point, nobody has to show any kind of restraint.
So if we're going to find a rational pathway to a multipolar world, which is what we're in the process of doing, part of this is turning around to Netanyahu, the people who finance him, and the dual citizens in the Congress and saying, sit down, shut up, we're putting the adults back in charge. Right?
Yes, but I don't think it's possible right now in the empire. I don't think it's happening. I think the adults in the room are the Chinese and the Russians. I don't see any adults in Washington.
So that's the question. You know, you have a group of interests who are basically, from what I can see, psychopathic, and they are willing to destroy the planet.
Yes.
To assert some kind of control. But the reality is, if I were in their shoes and I wanted to control, I wouldn't behave the way they're behaving. I go back to the zero days Stuxnet documentary.
Yeah, but you're not a psychopath.
Right.
That's the problem. You're not in the White House. The psychos are.
Right. So, you know, it's really funny. There's a wonderful book I love by a Polish scientist who basically did a study on the integration of, you know, the relationship between psychopathy and politics.
Yep, I know that.
Political ponerology. And what he said was, you know, it's not the psychopaths make everybody crazy until they finally realize, oh, they're not like you and me. They're psychopaths, and we need to organize and develop strategies to put the psychopaths back into their box and not let them control the governance structure. Because that's what we've got. We've got psychopaths controlling the governance structure, and it, you know, first of all, it's destroying the U.S. brand worldwide.
Yes, it is. It is,
and
absolutely.
There's nothing to be gained from that. In other words, whatever's going to happen, destroying our brand is not necessary. We don't need to do it. And it's going to make the, you know, the ultimate transition much more expensive and much harder. America has extraordinary goodwill around the world. It's still amazing to see the extent of the goodwill we still have. And there's no need to destroy it.
I completely agree with you. But the problem is that the people who are in power just don't want to see that. And it's more than just, you know, the government. I mean, when I see how in lockstep the U.S. media, the kind of accusations that are made against Tulsi Gabbard, for instance, you know, that really tells me that peaceful transition is most unlikely. The media still hasn't accepted that Trump has been elected. They can't even get over that.
The financial addiction to secrecy is extraordinary, but also the financial addiction to an official reality, which is not true, is extraordinary. So,
and they're all becoming accomplices. I mean, look at 9/11. The way the entire, you know, political elites in the U.S. and the media totally bought and supported the ridiculous narrative offered by the government puts them in a position of being accomplices now. Now that's a form of solidarity.
Well, that's a felony.
They're in the same boat now.
It's a felony. It's a felony.
No, I'm not denying that. It's exactly it. It's a felony.
So let me just turn. You had a great interview with Dmitry Orlov, who, for those of you who haven't listened to my interview with Dmitry Orlov, Dmitry was from a Russian background, but came to the United States and then went back during the rape of Russia and really watched and studied the collapse. And he's done marvelous discussions of, you know, sort of societies that collapse and how to prepare, et cetera. But you had a discussion with him, and you talked about the Ukraine. I want to just touch on the Ukraine before we close. And one of the things he described is how Russia, by ridding itself of what he calls the 14 piglets and pulling back into its core, has been able to reverse the sort of drain of the empire and rebuild. And I think that's important to – it's important to understand, because it doesn't look like the sanctions are really working. If anything, they're going the other way.
I mean, they're hurting Russia, but they're hurting Russia in a way that Russia needs, which is it forces Russia to change economic policies. So it's not like they're having zero effect, but their overall effect is a positive one, yes.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting, if you read the CIA literature on why Russia's going to fail, a big part of it is the demographics and the fact that their population is shrinking. One of the things you pointed out in the interview is people from the Ukraine immigrating to Russia.
Yes.
So Russia was smart. They didn't take responsibility for any of the territory. They left the territory as is. But now they're creaming off the best people.
Well, you're hitting on something which should be self-evident to anybody, but apparently is not, is that Russia does need more territory. So the notion that Russia would try to acquire more territory is just completely ridiculous.
Right.
Because Russia has enough territory right now. They're giving away, you know, entire land pieces in Siberia for free. And immigration is helping Russia. And in some ways it's not. In some ways it is. It's a mix. But definitely Russia can benefit it by, for instance, all the people. Okay, the Ukraine had a very advanced military-industrial complex.
Right.
The first thing that the Ukrainazis did, they severed all ties with Russia, which made these companies all essentially bankrupt. And the people who had the skills and the know-how and the habits, I mean, they know exactly. These were people who lived under one country in the past. They moved to Russia to start working on the Russian military-industrial complex, for instance, in shipping. There are many cases in aerospace. Definitely. I mean, Russia got a lot of people, but among those were also doctors, medical doctors. There were a lot of them were offered very good conditions in Chechnya by Ramzan Kadyrov. So they got their apartment there, and now the hospitals in Chechnya are staffed with very competent Ukrainian doctors.
Wow.
Yeah, Russia needs people much more than Russia needs territory. Russia doesn't need more territory.
Okay, so coming up in the next quarter, what should we watch for as sort of how these events unfold? What should we watch for both the Iranians doing, the Russians doing, the Americans doing, and the Chinese? We haven't brought up the Chinese. Where are the Chinese in all of this?
I think they're quietly and very effectively building an alternate system with other countries. That's what they're doing. There's nobody out there that wants the U.S. to collapse because it would be a dangerous collapse. But they also understand that the international system as it was completely controlled by the U.S. and pro-U.S. interests. So they're trying to find an alternative to that by creating regional organizations, by having regional initiatives, by basically building up an alternative and make it attractive to people to switch from one model to another. I think that's the fundamental plan of Putin and Xi Jinping.
Everything I see is very much bottom-up, deal-by-deal. You know, it's very practical. It's very reality, you know, objective-based reality, bottom-up.
Yep.
Sort of getting together and saying, okay, what are the 20 things we can do to improve liquidity and trade? You know, how do we build and for, you know, it's very practical.
Yeah, it's exactly that. There's no grand, you know, alliance or some kind of, you know, united military between Russia and China. None of that is happening. It's really on a project by project base.
Right. Okay, so for the next quarter, until we talk with you again, what do we watch? What do we keep an eye on?
Unfortunately, the same list, I would say. War with Iran, yes or no? I think probably not. But it's a guess of it because it's impossible to predict. You know, irrational people don't act rationally. So that's a big one, obviously. Venezuela, again, obviously, and total, we didn't discuss that very much, but complete chaos in the Ukraine with elections of Zelensky, who was clearly elected because he's not Poroshenko. But right now he's already, it's what he's been doing since he got elected is just very unimpressive. It's a mixture of buffoonery and jokes and saying completely mutually exclusive things. He says in Russian, he wants to negotiate with Russia, and then asked by a journalist in Ukraine, he says absolutely no negotiations with Russia. So clearly he doesn't really know what he's doing, and this could there be an internal collapse or resumption of not only a civil war, but further political disturbances with the new elections in the Rada, et cetera? Yes, the Ukraine is in a dangerous situation right now.
Right. I agree. So any closing thoughts, anything you want to say before we close?
No, except for I'm still watching. I mean, I know it's naive, but I'm still watching Tulsi Gabbard and what she says, and I'm surprised that she doesn't have more traction because she's basically saying the same things that Trump did when he was running, and a lot of people voted for him. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. She's not only saying it, but she's saying it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Senator Paul saying, you know, he's giving speeches to Pompeo about you don't have, you know, the authority to declare war without Congress. So you have a couple of sane voices, and you're right, they're not getting a lot of traction. And I hate to say this, Saker, but the reality is we have an economy and a stock market that is exceptionally dependent on the threat of war.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as though if you listen to Tulsi Gabbard and you understand what she's saying, you know, and you follow that thread, it unravels the entire official reality.
Yep. So I know people are very skeptical of her, and so am I, honestly. But on the other hand, I would say never. I think it's well worth keeping an eye on her just as a person that's at least a voice of sanity.
Right. I agree. I'm a fan. I think she's inexperienced and new, but if you look at what she's saying, she makes complete sense.
One problem. The negative thing is she hasn't dared to take on the Israel lobby. And unfortunately, that lobby is so crucial right now for the situation in the U.S. that, you know, it's like you can't treat a patient if you don't treat the most serious disease of that patient.
Right.
And she's been dealing with the consequences of the Israel lobby, but not naming the cause. And that's, I think, a sign of potential weakness. Because I think sooner or later, this topic will have to become visible and will have to, this country cannot recover as long as it's an occupied, essentially occupied territory.
So it's very interesting, because I've just, for the last quarter, I've had a lot about this on the Salera report and, mm-hmm. and talked about it a lot, because there is an incredible effort. If you are, if you attack the sort of psychopathic policies of Israel right now and its impact on the world, you are attacked as anti-Semitic. There's this huge game, you know, and if you look at the Holocaust marketing, you know, the way to do a Holocaust in, you know, of the Palestinians is to just throw, you know, World War II Holocaust in your face.
Absolutely.
And so it's a very clever marketing strategy. And one of the things I did was, I don't know if you've seen, there's a wonderful documentary by a very gifted young Israeli documentary maker called Defamation. And it's on the whole strategy of using all this stuff as a weapon.
It's basically, yeah, I think I've seen it.
Oh, it's fabulous. But it's sort of weaponizing victimhood status so that you can get away with murder. And it's amazing how far it's gotten them. But I think, you know, if you watch that push, it's a perfect, and I don't know if you've been following, but, you know, they've been running around to all the state governments trying to get laws passed state by state requiring to make it illegal to boycott, you know, Israel, which is
absolutely
totally unconstitutional.
And they even say that anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, that. I'm sorry. I should have brought that up because I wonder if I found it on your website. The State Department appointed a guy. This was like Pompeo's over the top thing. He's an assistant DA from LA. They appoint this guy, and he's in charge of monitoring anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
You know, worldwide. You couldn't make this stuff up. And the guy gets up and says, "If you're anti-Zionist, it's automatically anti-Semitic." And I couldn't stop laughing. And when you watch it, you think, you know, we are the clowns of the world. They can't, you know, why do they think this is going to work? And it gets back to what you said before, the psychopaths.
Yeah, the psychopaths. Yep. It's all I can, that explains why they're doing it.
Do we know how many people in Congress now have dual citizenship? We have no way of knowing.
No way of knowing, no.
Yeah. Well, that's the question, you know, who...
But you know what? It doesn't mean anything because you don't need dual citizenship to act as a comprador elite. So even those who don't have dual... I mean, Trump, I'm quite sure he probably... I mean, not sure, but he probably doesn't have Israeli citizenship. So what? He effectively is, you know, essentially the servant of Netanyahu.
Right. And so that gets back to who's in control and how are they controlling? And, you know, I hate to say this. We now have 325 million minus a few control files in America. And the question is, who controls them? Anyway. Okay. Well, much to be discussed. We will stay current on your website. Saker, I can't thank you enough for joining us quarterly. It's these are very insightful and rich discussions, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you. I'm so grateful you're in our lives.
Oh, well, it's an honor and always a pleasure for me, so I am very grateful to you.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this week on the Salera Report. Next week, we're going to be doing Deep State Tactics Part 2. Stay tuned. And again, as I always say, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. As you can tell from my discussion this week with the Saker, you really need to start one if you're not in one. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.